Radhika Jones, editor-in-chief of Vanity Fair. If you enjoy binge-watching the best TV shows and love hearing from the actors and showrunners who make them happen, then subscribe to Vanity Fair. Our Hollywood reporters take you behind the scenes of the year's most anticipated projects, the industry's biggest moves, and the hardest-fought awards races. From The Crown to The Real Housewives, we've got the inside scoop. As a special thank you to our still-watching audience, we're offering 15% off a yearly digital subscription to Vanity Fair. Visit vanityfair.com today and use promo code POD15. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a yearly digital subscription to everything you want.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive. Most of you aren't just listening right now. You're driving, cleaning, and even exercising. But what if you could be saving money by switching to Progressive? Drivers who save by switching save nearly $750 on average, and auto customers qualify for an average of 7 discounts. Multitask right now. Quote today at Progressive.com. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $744 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2022 and May 2023. Potential savings will vary. Discounts not available in all states and situations.
Vanity Fair.
Emerson, it stops here. I got your Funyuns.
Hello and welcome to Still Watching, a weekly television podcast from Vanity Fair. I'm Richard Lawson.
I'm Hilary Busis.
And I'm Chris Murphy. And we're here to discuss part one of season four of the HBO show True Detective Night Country.
Later on, Finn Bennett, who plays Detective Peter Pryor, is going to stop by and he's going to tell us about starting this new chapter of the True Detective story.
Well, to start things off, how do we feel about True Detective being back in general?
I feel like this is always me, but I didn't watch the third season, but I did watch the first two seasons. And I really enjoyed the first season. The second season was not my cup of tea. And I think I speak for many people who just sort of wasn't that into it. So I'm a little skeptical. I'm not like so excited, like, oh my God, I can't believe, I'm so happy it's back. But it does occupy a space in my mind and my heart, and I don't feel like we have many shows like it at
this
juncture.
It makes you think back to, like, the last golden age of TV. Mm-hmm. I feel like it was a really trend-setting show, not just in terms of a ton of crime-inspired dramas that came after it, but it was, you know, one of the first limited series that had, like, a big, splashy, like, movie star cast. I think it really set a wave of those into motion. I don't think it feels like a weird comparison, but I don't think you get Big Little Lies if you don't have True Detective season one.
Totally. Yeah, I do remember when that when the first season was announced, being like, wait, it's a proper miniseries and movie stars are doing it? And that was like a novel thing. Like, and it's so
funny. It
didn't
happen in 2015. Like, but now.
Like Julia Roberts is doing Stars. Yeah,
Meryl Streep's on the third season of a TV show. Like,
you get Julia Roberts doing a Watergate show that I'm the only person who watched.
One and a half, I watched half.
I reviewed it, Hillary.
But yeah, so I think like as a phenomenon, True Detective lives on. If you go back and you rewatch that first season itself, I don't know. I rewatched episode one just to prep for this, and I think it's a little emptier than we might remember it being. Like, I remember feeling like Emily Nussbaum in her New Yorker review, which was like famously very harsh on it. I felt like she was like the only person who was kind of getting at the stuff on the show that wasn't great, which was namely, you know, the
gratuitous violence against women.
The misogyny, yeah, was a big part. I mean, she had a great line from this review, which is, I mean, this is me summarizing first, that, you know, there's all this philosophical underpinning to the crime stuff. It's like marrying these two different sorts of things. On the other hand, now I'm quoting, you might take a close look at the show's opening credits, which suggest a simpler tale, one about heroic male outlines and close-ups of female asses. The more episodes that go by, the more I'm starting to suspect that those asses tell the real story.
That's pretty good.
Which is really good. Like, it was basically, you know, there was a nagging wife and there were a bunch of naked bodies and there were naked alive girls. And like, those were the varieties of women that you saw in that first season, as lauded as it was.
Yeah, and then I think that Pizzolatto tried to improve on that a bit in the subsequent seasons. I don't know how successfully, but, you know, I think the problems of True Detective aside, which are certainly real, I do enjoy an elevated genre thing, you know, like this is a cop procedural, but like it's an HBO version of that thing.
Yeah. We're going to have high production values. Yeah. We're going to have movie stars. We're going to, it's not Law and Order SVU.
It's going to be a little heady. It's going to be a little, you know.
Yeah, there's going to be something beyond just the crime.
Yes.
Right. It was the Yellow King in season one and this season. I don't know. Let's dive into this first episode. Let's get into a part one recap. There's something spooky happening at the Salal Arctic Research Station. A team of researchers have mysteriously vanished.
Clothes in that washer stink. It's going to take wet clothes a couple of days to stink that bad. These men disappeared 48 hours ago, at least. At least.
But the discovery of an indigenous woman's tongue at the crime scene reignites a cold case that detectives Liz Danvers and Evangeline Navarro worked on.
And then they cut out her tongue. They shut her the fuck up.
Danvers tries to figure out the connection between the facility and the dead woman and thinks the answer could lie in a parka worn by victims in both cases.
What are you looking for?
I don't know. Anything that might have belonged to her? Shoe? Earring?
A coat?
And to add to the mystery, the researchers are found frozen in the ice thanks to the help of a ghost named Travis.
Travis. Travis is dead. Rose.
I know.
We got a mysterious ice monster, maybe.
I know. This feels, I mean, just based on one episode at least, kind of supernatural. We have a ghost leading someone to the discovery of bodies. Like
a one-eyed polar bear.
All those caribou leaping off the cliff.
Yeah, like a suicide mission, those caribou it looked like. But yeah, I was, the supernatural element, it's not only supernatural, but it's so tied to sort of the basis of the show, which is indigenous people and white people who've taken over. And it seems to be sort of baked into the core, like, of the themes of the show in a way that I find to be kind of thrilling. It doesn't seem like peppered on, like, you know, a polar bear in Lost, you know? It feels baked into the DNA of the show.
It actually makes sense for the
show. It actually makes sense for the show in a way that is being interrogated, because you got Jodie Foster, who's so good, being kind of racist to her native coworker, Evangeline Navarro.
Yeah, I mean, it's I have some trepidation. My hope is that the supernaturally stuff is just trying to create mood and will not actually come to bear on the literal.
I imagine it's going to be similar to like a Yellow Jackets, where, you know, they've been very clear on that show. Like, there is a possible supernatural explanation for things. Everything that could be supernatural could also be explained by, you know, actual, like, non-magical reasons.
Events. Yeah.
Which I think is, you know, is a smart way to play it. It's maybe, you know, talking out of both sides of your mouth a little bit, but it does also, I think, keep things grounded without kind of destroying the mood.
Yeah. Like Rose, the character played by Fiona Shaw, like, she seems to have been led to this discovery by the ghost of this man or whoever he is. But maybe she just saw something, you know, like out on the ice and was just like, oh, I'm going to go look and we'll see what that is. You know, it is a big pile of bodies.
Well, we should get to the pile of bodies after we talk about the crime that led them to be. I mean, I will say, like, the pile of bodies is a ridiculous visual. Like, I gasped. Yeah. I hope you guys
I was like, whoa, they're really like going there.
It's kind of like grotesquely beautiful. It looked like a Renaissance painting.
I spoke to Issa Lopez for our first look at this season, and she called it the corpsicle.
There you go. Good, good.
Oh, that's good.
So just so you know, that's how we should be properly referring to it.
But yeah, we start with an interesting cold open.
I was going to do
one
that.
Of those.
You did it.
Yeah.
You got it. You,
where we get the first indication of something supernatural perhaps happening, in that the character goes into some sort of seizure and then says she's awake or something.
Mm-hmm.
She's awake.
And then all of a sudden they're all disappeared and there's a tongue on the ground.
Yeah, it's just bros being bros.
You thought they were just making a TikTok.
You know, making TikToks about sandwiches and watching Ferris Bueller sing Twist and Shout. And then something really scary happens that we don't know, but it was such the mood and vibe. So many TV shows don't have vibes anymore.
Yeah.
And the vibe is so wonderfully established. And then it continues when we get Billie Eilish's song and a real goddamn credit sequence.
Yep.
I love that credit sequence. God, it's so good. It feels like the song. I know it predates the show. It feels like it was written for it, though, right?
So appropriately creepy. And then also when you're like listening to like the words of the song too, it talks about like tongues. There's a line about a tongue in it. It's like, it's so
bury a friend. Yeah, there's a lot. It feels very the parallels are spooky.
Yeah,
for sure.
Spooky, scary, and I love spooky, scary Billie Eilish more than sad Billie Eilish.
And I like the spooky, scary mood being sort of offset immediately by the arrival of Jodie Foster's character, who is so sort of stern and of the real world and practical, you know? Like, I think if there is something, a suggestion of the supernatural, it would probably take her the longest to accept it, right, of anyone
here. She's so tethered to the ground. Something that I loved, Ree Jodie and her partner Kaylee Reese, who plays Evangeline Navarro, the show actually does subtext. We don't say like, oh, Kaylee Reese, Evangeline Navarro is good at her job. We see her arrest a guy and pick up the phone to be like, I'm actually busy because I'm arresting this drunk maniac of a guy. And she does it like so lickety split, so easy. I was like, oh, I immediately know from watching it that she's a really good cop and that she is really excellent at what she does.
Bitch, you broke my fucking nose.
Hey.
Miss, are you pressing charges?
What?
Damn right she is. Sir, you're under arrest for assault and battery.
And it's so nice to just see that and not be told that. For somebody being like, you're really good at your job.
Right. Yeah. And I think that, you know, between a character ominously saying she's awake, then the Billie Eilish song, the arrival of Danvers and Navarro arresting a domestic abuser, Issa Lopez is announcing pretty early on, this is a story about women and the violence perpetrated against them, but from a woman's perspective.
Yeah, which is a really smart way to put it in dialogue with that first season of True Detective without, you know,
writing it like in plain letters.
It's very plain from the beginning that, we're going, it's not just a vibe shift. It's not just that we're moving from Louisiana swamps to like the Alaskan tundra. Like, we are going to really interrogate that first season from a different perspective and explore kind of the criticisms against it while making a show that stands on its own,
without bludgeoning you over the head with like, this is the theme.
And I think the setting is so interesting because it's this remote town. There's a mine that's been set up to brought in a lot of outsiders, a lot of white outsiders. And it brings to mind the kind of fracking communities that sprung up, I believe, in North Dakota or South Dakota, you know, in the last 15 or so years. And you would read reports from those places and how women were treated in those places, and it was not good. But you also have a local population here to contend with, and like, I don't know. How do you guys feel about, like, the first season of True Detective is in the South. It sprawls. They drive long distances. There are many different locations. But here we kind of, by nature of the plot, are very contained. Mm-hmm. Does it feel small to you guys?
I love it, honestly, because one, it feels true to form. I mean, Alaska, there are these towns. There was an article recently, or actually from a few years ago, about Whittier, Alaska, where the whole town lives in one apartment complex, one building. Yeah. And you feel that on the show. It takes a little while. We're like, oh, wait, Jodie Foster and her, you know, she's got a young partner or up-and-comer and then an old guy. And it provides so many baked-in relationships that make the drama, it heightens the drama.
Yeah, the small town feel is nice. Like, you know, when she slams on her brakes and there's like that drunk lady and it's like, oh, that's Stacey. Like, she's the town drunk.
Yells from the window, she's doing it again, you know. I thought it was an interesting narrative. I mean, kind of on those lines, it's an interesting narrative choice. So normally in the kind of cliched cop movie where people are partnered up, they don't know each other and they have to get to know one another. But here it's clear that Danvers and Navarro
have a
backstory. And I think that's, I don't know, I kind of like, it feels like this first episode is setting up not only the central mystery, but there are like personal mysteries to these characters, things alluded to that I'm curious to see unpacked.
Yeah, for me, it just raises the stakes. Also because something about Night Country and something that's so great, you think Night Country is going to be so dark, but the snow, it's so expansive, it looks expansive.
Yeah.
The snow really widens and just
I feel like I've said this already, but thank goodness for a show that takes place at night, but I can actually tell what is
because
going on.
Because the snow gleams. Yeah. Thank God.
Thank God it is lit.
We can see the people.
You did the first look, Hillary, like you mentioned, and it was filmed in Iceland, right?
Mm-hmm. It was filmed in Iceland over the course of several months.
It must have been miserable.
So cold.
I cannot imagine. It must have been so, I mean, you know, they're not outside all the time. Mm-hmm. There are scenes that take place on a soundstage or whatever. But yeah, it's a lot of nighttime exterior. Like, it's actually minus like 50 degrees or whatever in real life. Like, I mean, I guess it means that you don't have to do as much acting.
Right.
But it does seem like a tough experience. Although, yeah, it would contribute to the performance. I think that, you know, when the cast is cloistered like that, when kind of all they have is each other, then, yeah, there's definitely, I think, a bond that develops and something that you can really see on screen, because mm-hmm. it does feel like, you know, these are residents of a small town, because they kind of are. Like, that's what a production is.
Yeah. And the night setting is so interesting in that, like, I felt already in just one episode, like, very temporally displaced. Like, when Danvers gets the call that her daughter, stepdaughter, Leah, has been, or some other kid's mother is like, you need to come now. I was like, but it's like midnight. Shouldn't these teenagers be asleep? And it's like, no, it could very easily be 3
p.m.
Yeah. You know, and I like that the show doesn't go to a ton, or so far anyway, doesn't go to a ton of pains to, like, be like, it's now noon, you know?
Yeah.
Like, it kind of wants us lost in that, I think.
Yeah, it's like being inside of a casino. There's, like, no clocks. Yeah.
Exactly.
I will say, based on that, and maybe I'm looking too much for, like, lesbian foreshadowing, because I feel like the show has been described as, like, the lesbian True Detective, you know, like, and whatnot. But I was like, oh, my gosh. Like, I was sort of ready for Jodie Foster's character, Liz Danvers, to be maybe queer. But then we get the daughter being queer, clearly. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, that's really interesting. It kept sort of subverting my expectations in that way. And I keep looking for little breadcrumbs of maybe this is queer. And then we see Navarro, like, having sex with that guy who seemed really fun. I was like, okay, maybe she's not the queer character. But then that sex scene I thought was so interesting, because it seemed so about power for her more than about pleasure.
Yeah.
And that's what I picked up on. Like, not that she wasn't having fun and wasn't experiencing pleasure, but it was such a power dynamic of her, you know, Navarro being a woman and taking over.
And that feels like a statement, too, based on, you know, how many sex scenes we've seen, especially in prestige shows like this, where, you know, it is just about, like, it's prurient. Sorry, I can't talk. it's salacious. It's, you know, about, like, a naked woman, like, for the sake of there being a naked woman. And this does feel like a response to that.
Yeah, for sure. I think there are plenty of scenes of troubled, be they cops or soldiers, men having sort of, like, emotionless, you know, mechanical sex.
Yeah.
And, like, in this case, we get the opposite. And then it's the guy who runs the diner or whatever, like, or the bar, who seems kind of sweet and, like, you know, and I think that that's an interesting
just let
shift.
Him, like, give you a toothbrush.
Exactly. A SpongeBob toothbrush, even. Yeah. And then, of course, that guy employs her sister, because the town is so small.
Right. Her seemingly very troubled sister, which, you know, adds yet another psychological element to
this. Yeah, well, you see that, and that is a ticking time bomb on a show like this. I don't want to read too much.
You don't think it's there just for, like, window dressing?
No, she's. I think that the emotionally troubled sister is going to wind up being just fine.
Yeah. Okay. Good. Okay.
Thank God.
We can have that sorted. That's good.
Yeah.
I think that this episode is setting up a really interesting dynamic between men and women on the show. Obviously, Navarro, part of her anger toward the person she arrests, maybe her anger in sex, is that she has this cold case from 6 years ago that she just cannot shake because of its incredibly violent nature. A native woman, like, horribly mistreated.
Tongue cut out,
which is why, you know, maybe, okay, is this the same tongue, you know, et cetera. We don't know, but, like, it would seem so. And I thought it was really interesting. We didn't talk yet about Hank Pryor, the John Hawks character, where he has this case file, but he, for whatever reason, doesn't want Danvers to have it. So I think already this show is being like, there is a lot of conspiracy or at the very least, men protecting other men.
Which also feels very True Detective-y. Like, this goes all the way to the top.
Yeah.
Right, exactly. Or conversly, how deep does it go?
Yeah.
How deep does it go? I find that to be really interesting. And I think the show, without sort of making the blatant statement, like, women of color, when they're kidnapped and they're murdered and whatnot, people don't care as much as when white people, white men are kidnapped. We see that, you know, we don't even know if these men, at least for most of the episode, if they're missing or if they're out on an expedition or if they're dead, but the whole town is a flutter, or Jodie and her team is a flutter to find these white men. Whereas, you know, this native woman, she's brutally murdered, stabbed 32 times. That case can just go cold because of, you know, how society treats women of color. I think that's going to be a pretty important dynamic that's going to be explored from multiple angles, but it is laid pretty bare.
And also something, you know, very much based on fact, like, it's been getting more attention recently, but, like, missing and murdered Indigenous women is, you know, its own, like, genre of case, like, because this happens so frequently to so many people and so few of them are found or, like, answers are found about what happened to them that, it can kind of sustain its own
entire subset of crime.
Of crime.
When you talked to Lopez, did she say like that was very deliberate in the creation of it? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, and actually, I mean, this is it's sort of funny. I think that it's something that media started to pay more attention to, and then art also started to pay more attention to, because, you know, you look at like the work of Taylor Sheridan, like there have been more like missing and murdered Indigenous women stories. In, you know, the past 5 years even. Anissa Lopez acknowledged that and was like, now, you know, it's almost becoming a cliche. But yeah, it was important to her to incorporate that. I think that once you, it's funny also, originally Navarro was written to be Latina.
Oh, okay.
And she changed her to be Indigenous or to be a half Indigenous person once she really started digging into Alaska and was like, oh, I can't set a story here without having a real Native component, without like actually digging into Native stories, you know, even though she herself is not. But yeah, so the mystery itself, while I'm talking about my interview with Issa Lopez, I should get into this. So it is also based in a couple of real life still unsolved mysteries, like the sorts of things that are on the show Unsolved Mysteries, historical, very mysterious incidents. One of them is the Mary Celeste, which was an American ship that drifted ashore. And the entire crew had apparently disappeared. Like, they had left behind their food and their shoes were, like, next to their beds or whatever. Like, it is totally, it seemed as though not like the crew had been killed and thrown overboard, but they just disappeared. They just vanished.
Like Roanoke Colony
basically
stuff.
Yeah. Whoa. Yeah. And the other one was more recent in the 1900s at some point. It's called pronounce things in Russian, but it's called the Dyatlov Pass incident.
Oh, yes. I've heard about this. Yeah.
So okay, I have not heard about this.
So nine Russian hikers go out into the wilderness.
Like young guys, right?
Yeah, young guys like going on a hike. They abandoned their campsite for some reason. They all froze to death, like nearby, looked terrified, totally unclear what happened to them. They're just like all dead. There's no easy explanation for what happened.
Do they look like a Renaissance painting? Like in this? Yeah.
They are not all frozen, I think, in one big disgusting clump. Dante-esque lump. But in recent years, the Dyatlov Pass incident has been potentially explained by scientists who think that maybe there was an avalanche that either they were looking at or caught in.
Oh God!
Makes sense. Okay, but they're not. These guys weren't in the mountains.
No,
they're in the middle of nowhere. They're in the middle of tundra. Yeah,
and they were safely warm inside.
Yeah.
Well,
she woke up.
You can like breathe easy knowing that I don't think an avalanche is going to be the answer, because Issa Lopez was like, I think that's bullshit.
That's bullshit. Okay.
Like, that's not what happened. It doesn't explain everything. Yeah. It can't be true. These are two, you know, pre-existing mysteries that inspired the show. I suggest reading up on them. They're like very wild, very spooky. As spooky as Bury Your Friend. Well,
I can't read up of them after watching this show and then go to sleep at night.
I know. It's like when I used to watch Walking Dead every Sunday night and I would have horrible nightmares. And I was like, why do I keep having nightmares? And it was like, oh, because you're watching the zombie show right before you go to sleep.
Yeah. That's a mystery that you solved.
I did, and I stopped watching it.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know. I the more we talk about it, like, and you know, bringing in those two real world creepy incidents, like, I like this show in its fourth iteration making a turn into horror, which is kind of what this feels like. I mean, if we have some ghost guy doing a weird dance out on the on the tundra or whatever, and this
a guy who appears to be an actual ghost.
Right.
And this walking around in ice. Yeah.
And this Hieronymus Bosch painting of dead bodies. Like, it's like, I don't know, just in general in this episode, the way the show's lit and everything, it feels horror-y. And I like that while also being a little bit nervous it's going to maybe pursue that. Those tropes a little too far.
Nervous in that you don't think it's going to work, or in that you personally are going to be scared?
Maybe both, actually. Maybe both. But I think, I don't know, I'm just, I think I probably shouldn't think this way when I watch things, but I was like, I was worrying about like fan reaction. I was like, are people going to see this and be like, oh, this isn't the same True Detective? I mean, but the other three seasons are distinct from one another, so maybe it's not a problem.
Totally.
And I think it is, because, it's got the essential. Navarro and Danvers have not, you know, officially started working together yet. So
We're assuming they will.
It's probably going to happen. I think something, and this might be a horror trope, but it sort of didn't feel horror to me, and I appreciated sort of the flashback element of it. I think they're very well done. I think it's so
I love that there is one timeline and that we get occasional flashbacks, but we are not jumping between two of them.
I know, because they could easily be like, here's Navarro 6 years ago investigating this case. Mm-hmm. And I'm so, yeah, I'm very
thrilled that we are getting one story, one linear chronological story.
What a concept. But it is really great. And the flashbacks really, I mean, the one of Navarro in war, I was like, oh my God, it was so crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
It's really sort of intense and evocative. And it's like a peppering through the through the episode.
Although, I mean, if we're going to talk about tropes, like Navarro being a vet does feel sort of done, sort of on the nose, in the same way that, you know, we don't know for sure if Jodie Foster had a family that, you know, she no longer has. But we see her, you know, we hear a child's voice whisper she's awake. We see the polar bear in the street. It seems as though Jodie had, you know, maybe there was a dead child involved, maybe.
Yeah. And I mean, I will say once her daughter, Leah, when she's in the car, is like, first, me being an asshole, I was like, that girl does not look like Jodie Foster. Mm-hmm. And then it's revealed, it's like, oh, it's not her kid.
Yeah,
you know?
But it seems like there is a biological child that she no longer has. And, like, I can understand that as, you know, using that for a character, giving them, like, something dark in their past. If they're a woman, like, it is likely that this is going to be the thing that you saddle them with. I find it's a little cliched for me. I sort of wish that... I don't know. It feels a little easy.
But the whole family dynamic, I guess.
But the family dynamic is weird.
It's so weird, whatever it is, because it's like she's got a son with her, with Hank or whatever.
I think that's just his son.
That's his, but it's but I don't know yet.
Why do you think, why do you think that Peter is Jodie Foster's son?
Peter.
Just the way they interact.
The way they interact. Yeah. It feels very familial to me.
Yeah, I feel with Peter, maybe I'm just mayor of Easttown pilled, but I'm worried about him.
Oh, really?
Evan Peter vibe.
The cute
Evan
young
Peters.
Cop. Yeah. You know, I don't know if he's going to meet a good end, but we'll see. But yeah, no, I think you're right, Chris. I think I couldn't quite decide watching the episode if these dynamics were deliberately a little confusing or if I was maybe a little missing something in the writing. Yeah. But like we, the audience, I think it's very interesting that there is no audience surrogate. Mm-hmm. We are entering a fully contained world where everyone already knows each other.
Totally.
And the only mystery
is also refreshing. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's different. Yeah. Like,
the person who hopped off the train and is in the town.
Like,
the
I love the movie Insomnia where Al Pacino goes to Alaska to solve a murder and ends up committing one. That's a great movie. But, like, I think this would have felt like a rehash of that in some ways. And now it's the only real kind of unknown people in some ways to anyone in this community are these research guys.
Are these nerdy scientists.
So these complete strangers are the dead ones.
Yeah. Yes.
And I think that's really cool.
Yeah. Should we talk about the scientists at all?
Yeah.
I love the one who's named Ralph Emerson.
That's good.
Yeah, they have some great names.
W. Emerson.
I'm sort of wondering, like,
Emerson.
Yeah, how that bears on. If it would be funny if it were like Lost and they were all just named like John Calvin.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
We do have Ralph Emerson.
Yeah, we have our Ralph Emerson. I'm sure that the other names in there are
clues,
references of some kind.
Yeah.
But yeah, we don't really know what they were doing there. We learn that some of them are geophysicists, geologists, paleomicrobiology is mentioned. Mm-hmm. So I guess they're looking for things under the ice.
Which, I would, you know, then are we also telling a climate story? Like, is this like
there
the ice is melting and stuff that should have stayed in there is now coming out?
Yeah. Well, they talk about that under the tundra, all these diseases that if climate change continues, the tundra could thaw, and then we're having like diseases we haven't seen in hundreds of years.
I didn't.
We're all gonna get dinosauritis.
Yeah. I had that in 93 when I saw Jurassic Park on opening day.
But you know, you're totally right though that there is definitely a climate thing because we have the miners, right? Mm-hmm. And that seems. And Annie was a protester. She was an activist. We learned that in this episode that
It maybe doesn't take a genius to connect these things.
Yeah,
I think it's interesting that Danvers says kind of. In her tone, kind of sides with the miners on that. She was like, she was really annoying, but no one deserves, you know, what happened.
Well, I think that's a good, the Danvers of it all, and I sort of glibly called her racist at the very beginning, but I do think there is a very interesting and maybe even true to form sort of racial animus between Danvers and Navarro, where she's not like explicitly like a racist, but she clearly has very sort of rude opinions about Native people and is unafraid to
which is interesting
throw them
if
out.
One of them is her stepdaughter or whatever.
Yeah, she's raising one effectively that I think will be I'm like keeping an eye on that because I do think it complicates her character from being just like a tough broad police lady detective where she clearly has relationships with Native people and has opinions and says rude things about, shouldn't you be shucking a caribou or whatever she says, but also is clearly embedded in that community in some way via what seems to be her daughter, stepdaughter.
Yeah, and it makes, you know, Danvers seem, I feel like we get a better sense of who Danvers is as a personality from this first episode than Navarro, who is still kind of coming to the forefront some, but like, you know, yeah, Danvers is clearly complicated. She's clearly, you know, the cliche of like, you know, she's a good cop, but like her personal life is a mess seems kind of apparent here too. Yeah. But it seems, yeah, she's complicated maybe in interesting ways.
But I like her, and Jody's doing some great work for me.
I love her versus the Ferris Bueller TV.
Trying to turn that off.
Really. I feel like I have been in that situation.
Does Peter say we tried to put a, or one of the cops says we tried to put a blanket over to dampen the sound? And it's like, why would that have worked?
I will say back to the cold open, I was so confused. I was like, wait, did this all happen in the 3 minutes of the Ferris Bueller clip? But it turns out they're rewatching the clip over and over and over again. It's like a YouTube
because
video.
Whatever,
it's not the movie.
The ice monster that killed the scientists also broke the TV.
As ice monsters are wont.
That's how you know she means business. And yes, I did say she.
Well, it's Jennifer Grey from Ferris Bueller, of course.
She's upset because she got that nose job.
Exactly.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. And when we return, a conversation with actor Finn Bennett, who plays Peter Pryor.
We've all been there before. You're planning a dinner party or having family over or even just cooking for yourself when all of a sudden it starts to feel overwhelming.
I live in a very small one-bedroom apartment with a very small kitchen.
I can't figure out what to serve besides water soup at this point.
I'm Chris Morocco, food director of Bon Appetit and Epicurious, and this is Dinner SOS, a new podcast from Bon Appetit. Maybe it's a last-minute party with no menu inspiration, a kitchen with no space, a toddler who will only eat buttered pasta. Name your dinner emergency. We're here to help. Here's how the show works. On each episode, we'll take a call from a home cook facing a real dinner emergency. Then, I'll work with one of our editors or someone from our amazing test kitchen to try and solve it. Because cooking for the people you love should inspire joy without a side of stress. Make sure you're following Dinner SOS wherever you're listening now.
This message comes from Apple Card. Earn up to 3% daily cash back on every purchase every day. Then grow it at 4.50% annual percentage yield when you open a savings account with Apple Card. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card subject to credit approval. Savings available to Apple Card owners subject to eligibility. Savings accounts provided by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, member FDIC. Terms apply. It's official. Ennis, Alaska is creepy and very Sixth Sense-y. Everybody sees dead people, it seems.
They do, yeah. I do feel like Travis is kind of a funny name for a ghost. Like, do you think this is like where Travis Birkenstock ended up?
Yeah, actually, that would kind of make sense. But to help us unpack this first episode and the weirdness of Ennis, Alaska, we got a chance to talk to Finn Bennett, who plays Peter Pryor. He obviously is the young detective who Liz Danvers has taken under her wing. Maybe it's her son. We don't know. Anyway, maybe Finn can shed some light on that. Enjoy our conversation.
Hello, Finn Bennett. Welcome to Still Watching.
Hi, Finn.
Hi, guys. How are you?
Oh, it's so
a little
great to
spooked
have you
out.
Yeah. Why are you spooked out?
The first up, it's kind of a scary show, Finn.
It's good, isn't it?
It's really good. I'm curious. Were you a True Detective fan before you got involved with Night Country?
Yeah, big True Detective fan, particularly of season one. So you can imagine kind of my joy when I found out I was going to be a part of it.
What was the process like for you booking the role? How long did the auditions take? How did you find out?
So I had the kind of unusual process of casting. And I mean, Issa has this ability to find people. And Issa had watched a series that I had done over here in the UK called Kiri. And I'd also auditioned for a series that she was doing in the UK, but it was a different block. So anyway, when she called me up in, I guess like April 2022 and said, I've got something and I want you to audition for it. I was like, oh, brilliant. You're shooting like something for the BBC? And she was like, no, it's True Detective, HBO. I was like, well, I'll never get it. So we did a meeting. The two of us had a meeting, and I read some stuff for her and we talked over the character and stuff. And then she gave me COVID. I couldn't go in for that. Yeah, no, and now she's giving me the part as like a kind of
twist. It's like a Night Country-esque twist that she gives you COVID.
Yeah. It's very in keeping with the show. So I couldn't go in to do the second meeting, which meant I had to do it with my friend, who's a brilliant actor, and he kind of understood the gravity of the situation. So we kind of worked away for about 3 hours on these two scenes. We sent them in. Issa said, you know, like, look, I love them, but we don't know what HBO are going to say. Here we are. So, so it worked out. Okay.
It all worked out. Even the COVID of it all.
I guess I was like, that was a good insurance policy for HBO going into the show.
Well, yeah, you weren't going to get it again right away.
But I did. No. I did again.
No, you did while shooting this.
I did.
While shooting.
Like in Iceland?
Yes, in Iceland. Wow. Yeah, I had one week left, and I called Issa up in the morning. I said, so I've tested positive. That happened.
Obviously, I feel like we're talking about this to everybody that we interview who is not Jodie Foster. You get to act with Jodie Foster. That feels like a pretty exciting opportunity.
Yeah, cool.
Tell us about meeting her and, you know, the first thing you guys shot together.
I met Jodie, I was like coming out of a fitting and she was like going in, and that, you know, you have the kind of whole, her legend among the people, everyone in that building is kind of this huge thing. And I was really terrified about meeting her, but you meet this incredibly friendly, warm, patient, understanding person. And you kind of, all the kind of fear, I mean, everything you were worried about kind of slips away. And when you're in that scene, she's there with you. And she's not, she never, once the camera's off her, it's not like she stops doing her job. You know, she's giving you everything while you're in there, in the scene with her, which is kind of amazing for someone. She really doesn't have to do that for me, but she did. And yeah, I think the kind of relationship we developed on screen, I'm really, really proud of. And I'm also kind of selfishly proud of myself for you know, acting with Jodie Foster.
That's you should be proud. That's a very cool thing.
Well, your relationship with her is very interesting and seems very close. So close that
so
while
close.
Watching the first episode, Chris thought that Peter was Danvers' son.
Which I think is maybe fair, because it's clear that, well, John Hawks, Hank, Peter, and Liz Danvers, right? They all sort of know each other in a intimate ways. Danvers and Hank have their own relationship. Hank and Peter, Hank is Peter's dad, but I, for a big chunk of the episode, thought that they were all a little family, a little dysfunctional family.
I love that take on it. It's so sweet. And they're all in police.
They're just a police family.
Yeah. They really run that town. I love that take on it. But no, I guess you could say, you know, in some aspects, there is a maternal element to Danvers and Pryor's, Peter Pryor's relationship. So, you know, Chris, you were, yeah, it's a fair point.
Like, thank you. Yeah. Thank you. I appreciate that. I was wrong, but you know, but it does, the relationship between Danvers and Pete does definitely have sort of a maternal element of her sort of shaping him to be this, you know, amazing true detective, if you will.
I did talk to Issa before the show for like a preview piece, and the way that she described Peter is kind of like a Clarice Starling figure before, you know, she gets, you know, loses her innocence. Is that something that ever came up on set between you?
Yes. I mean, specifically the Clarice Starling bit, no, but I think in terms of his innocence and how earnest he is, and how ignorant he is about the world at large, all the other characters, the older characters, they all have their kind of emotional baggage. And he's quite bright-eyed and bushy-tailed. He just kind of leaps into the situation. He just wants to solve the case. He just loves it. And then there's this whole relationship with his family. He's a young dad, and that plays a big part in kind of when I was reading it, I was always imagining, if you put Pryor in the middle, there's kind of different people pulling him from different angles, his family, his dad, Danvers, the case. And I think, yeah, there's a great point about the Clarice Starling thing. I would never compare myself to Clarice Starling, but yeah, thank you.
You brought up such an interesting thing in terms of the fact that Peter is this young, you know, dad, seems to have a lot of responsibility, and also that he's married to a Native woman and he's, you know, obviously white. And it feels like the show is setting up a pretty sort of intense dynamic between, you know, the Native indigenous people from Alaska and also the white people from Alaska, and sort of that tension. And they seem to be at opposite odds with the mind and whatnot. Can you talk a little bit about Peter being, you know,
yeah, he's sort of in the middle of everything.
In the middle of everything, right?
Yeah. And
connected to both sides.
That's such a good question. And I mean, it's something I personally have had to learn an awful lot about, because I'm sure there is an indigenous community here where I live in London, but I can't imagine it's very big. So this was kind of a whole new world to me. Shamefully, I wish I knew more about it. So I was learning all of these things, and I was learning about all of these tensions, and that came from the fellow cast, from Anna, who plays Kayla, from Izzy, or Isabella, sorry, who plays Leah, from Kaylee, of course. So it was coming from them, but it was also, and I just want to mention Peej, who is this guy who I was put in touch with for research. He's not actually from Alaska, but he has moved to Alaska, and he's a white guy with a Native wife, and they have a little baby and stuff. So I got in contact with Peej, or Issa put us in contact, and I was learning all this stuff about them, and it was a big learning process. And I think you try to, it's such a shame when you finish a project and that you know so much more than you did at the start, you just want to go back and do it all again. and how that would have impacted your performance, you know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. That's so interesting, though. There is a real Peter Pryor that you spoke to.
Yes, yeah. He's not a cop. He is, I believe he's a preacher, but really nice guy. And we spoke maybe like once a week on the phone for like a solid month or something.
Wow.
I would ask him questions about his family and kind of more bigger questions that were maybe more profound. But then at a certain point, I just kind of was just like interested in like, what did you have for dinner? What's your favorite music? You know, like, this is such like a new life to me.
Yeah, well, Alaska seems, yeah, it's a world away from a lot of places, but especially a world away from, you know, urban London.
Yeah, a complete world away. And hearing how they would kind of hunt and go out on the land and all of the customs and practices that he had to get used to being, I suppose, a visitor in his partner's world. And yeah, so that was really interesting.
Clearly, I mean, it's in the name True Detective Night Country, but you're sort of stuck, you know, many months filming really in darkness for so long with a cast that, you know, everyone seems to be so connected in the show, right? You know, it knows each other, is related, is not related. What was it like for the cast, you know, off screen, you know, when you're not shooting? Did you hang out? Were you all sort of huddled together in Iceland?
Were you huddled together for warmth? Were you under a blanket? Dude,
so I had I was in an apartment, like in an apartment complex, and I could go out onto, I had like a little patio outside. I could go out, I could wave to Kaylee up here, like just around the corner. That was Izzy. You could do a little wave to her. We were really, really close, and I feel incredibly lucky that I made friends that for kind of no other reason I have met in any other walk of life. So yeah, we were really close, and we would go out. I did a lot of eating. Iceland's fantastic food, lots of fish. We did some drinking, we went to movies, you form a little family, and I'm so proud and honored to be part of that family.
How creepy was it, you know, those first scenes when you're walking into like the abandoned lab and, you know, there's tongues everywhere and, you know, this like, what was that experience like?
Salal kind of is just so impressive from even, you know, I've been on like sets before and I've done this kind of stuff, but I think anyone just coming into to sell out or what we made sell out, it would just be so impressed by the scale of the thing. Like it's a whole building that they've created, and Daniel Taylor and his team did just such like an amazing job of making it so barren and creepy and soulless, I think. And, you know, coming into walking through those rooms, it really sets up the scene nicely. And so obviously this is kind of focused on episode one, but throughout the series, you just see some of the most incredible sets.
How did you feel looking at the corpsicle for the first time? That's the big reveal at the end of this episode.
Yeah, that was really horrible. It was like the more you look at it, the kind of more you kind of double take, like, seeing that for the first time, and also because I'd seen it kind of at varying stages of completion.
Mm. Oh, wow.
So at first you kind of see quite like a mesh of plastic and you're like, this isn't good enough. And then it becomes this thing. Slowly they add layers, and so much time and work goes into, you know, if a guy's hand is like frozen, you can see the kind of like veins pop out where he's like tensing his muscles. It just, all of this stuff is like so incredible. And it really pays off when you look at it. Like, it just looks great on screen. So, yeah.
There seem to be a lot of important details in the opening credits. I know, you know, we can't speculate. We're only on episode one. But is there anything that we should be paying attention to while we're listening to that creepy Billie Eilish song before the episode starts?
Pay attention to the spirals. You love that. Yeah, yeah. That's fun.
Yeah, because there's one that Jodie stands in the middle when she's looking at there's a spiral.
Yeah, how cool is that?
Yeah, it's so cool.
Because I obviously was not in as nearly as much as Jodie and Katie, but I would come in and watch the scenes that I thought were going to be really cool. So I kind of watched that one from a distance. I was like, oh, loving this. Like, it was, So watch out for spirals. Watch out for oranges. Mm. So that's quite a weird clue, but watch out for oranges, yeah.
God, oranges and spirals. Okay, that's something that we can...
And you can get to the bottom of this case in a heartbeat.
Like that.
Right away. Yeah, Finn, thank you so much for joining us.
Yeah, thanks so much.
This is really cool.
Yeah.
I'm loving this. Thank you so much, guys.
Still Watching will be back in just a moment. When we return, we will make our predictions on whodunit.
And if you are watching this video, either I'm dead or I'm in a very, very, very bad situation.
She said, oh my God, I can hear gunshots. I can hear men outside.
Where are they? What have they done to them? Are they dead? Are they not dead?
There is one suspect, her father, the Sheikh.
It's Madeline Barron from In the Dark. We've teamed up with our new colleague, Heidi Blake, at The New Yorker to try to answer a question about one of the richest men in the world, the ruler of Dubai.
Why do the women in Sheikh Mohammed's family keep trying to run away?
There's 5 policemen outside and 2 policewomen inside the house. So basically, I'm a hostage.
And he reminded me that Sheikh Mohammed can get me anywhere.
Because you're a rich and powerful person, you can effectively break any law you want in our country and get away with it.
The Runaway Princesses is available now. Follow In the Dark wherever you get your podcasts.
So we're going to, as we did for White Lotus, I believe, we said we used to predict who's going to die, but now I think we're going to predict who done it.
Who done it, yeah.
And we're going to try to do it every week, and we're going to hold ourselves accountable because whoever gets it closest to right, which we'll have to subjectively decide at the end, gets an icy.
Yeah.
Bought by the other two hosts.
Seems so fitting, given the setting and the...
Chris...
Yeah, did you guys catch that? It's a joke. It's a funny joke we made.
We can hear you laughing right now.
Yeah. Chris, who do you think did it?
I'm going to say, just because I did not like his vibes, and I did not like the way that he talked to Miss Liz Danvers, mm-hmm. I think it's Peter Pryor's dad. Hank, is that his name?
Hank Pryor. Yeah.
Hank Pryor.
And by it, we're talking about the scientists.
Yeah, which seems like, you know, white violence.
There are two mysteries.
There's Andy Kay also. Well, I think he's... Okay, I'm going to say he's responsible for both right now.
Okay.
Because it would be very surprising for him to be responsible for Annie Kay. That makes more sense. You know, I could see that. But I think he's maybe responsible for the murders of the scientists just because, I don't know, he's got this mail order bride coming. I don't know. I don't like his vibes. I don't like the look about him. He seems like a shifty, shady character to me.
My theory about the scientists is something of a Scooby-Doo theory.
Ooh.
Where environmental activists pretended to be ghosts or ghouls to scare them off, and they're going to do the same to the miners.
Oh.
That's my theory. And for Annie Kay.
And they could have gotten away with it if it weren't for that meddling Danvers.
this meddling Foster. Yeah, and then Annie Kay, I think, I kind of feel you on Hank, too. Because the shiftiness about the case file.
So. Yeah, why did he keep that from...
He seems to somehow be involved, if he didn't cut out her tongue himself.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it would be more surprising if, like, Peter was some... Because he seems like the innocent, right?
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
If he has something to do with any of this...
That would be a
good twist.
Yeah, exactly. Because we would expect him just to be the sweet young cop who dies. But.
And I also, I don't know, I want to... I got burned by this during Mare of Easttown by being like, why is Guy Pearce on this show if he doesn't have anything
right.
to do with the murder?
Right.
True.
Why is Fiona Shaw on this show if she doesn't have anything to do with the murder?
That's an interesting question.
That is a very good question.
Like, what's her whole deal?
Right.
There's
right.
something weird going on there.
There is something weird going on.
I don't know what she could have to do with it, but...
Well, she woke up and then everyone died. Well, that does it for this episode of Still Watching. As ever, you can find me on social media at Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
And you can find me on social media at Chris Triss.
You can find me at Hillabuster.
This has been Still Watching from Vanity Fair. Our producer is Emily Elias, and we had production help from Peyton Hayes. We had technical assistance from Gabe Quiroga. Stephen Valentino is our executive producer, and our theme music is by Alexis Quadrado. We'll be back next Sunday for part two. Looking forward to seeing you then.
The Run Through with Vogue is where you'll meet all the most exciting people in fashion and culture.
I am Fran Lebowitz, who should be the mayor of New York.
We all support that. We support that.
Very nice.
Nikki.
Yes.
It's been really great being in this beautiful pink room.
All right, Usher, can you hear us?
I can hear you.
All right.
Can you hear me?
We can.
We can.
All right, here we are.
On the podcast, you'll learn how Vogue really works.
Sometimes we'll come in for a second or even third run through until we are AWOK.
Can you tell us what AWOK means?
It means AWOK, Anna Wintour OK.
I'm Cho Minardi.
And I'm Chloe Mel.
And we're the hosts of The Run Through with Vogue, where fashion and culture collide.
Join us. It's AWOK.
Listen and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.